You'll hear this, just makes me so, so sad. The crow flies straight. It's Kevin Undergar, your captain, with my Lieutenant Commander, Roxy Stryer.
Hi, Kev.
In studio with us, Chuck Saffler of the FX Networks. Chuck, we didn't know what your... There's multiple titles for you online. What's your official title?
President, Program Strategy, and COO, or Chief Operating Officer.
That's of all of the FX Networks, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I hear this, Chuck, and I get sad because I miss Sons of Anarchy so much, and I, like everyone else.
Me too.
Right? You yeah. Right? Don't you as a fan?
Oh, dude. Dude, that's the best part of this job is like, okay, the job is you got to look at the episodes that you're making, and Sons of Anarchy is just a masterpiece every week.
Every week.
And then it goes away.
Yeah. My dad and I are usually like this on TV. He's here, I'm here, we're all over the place. This is the one show that we both loved, watched every single week, talked about. Like, you were a reason that I got to call my father to talk about the episode. This was the best show. I hate that it's gone. So here's a show
like that where you're both, as a businessman, you're obviously, you know, you have to do your job as you get these scripts and you read them. But do you still read them a little bit as a fan? Will you get excited to read the stories?
Dude, scripts, cuts, everything.
Really?
Yeah. It's the best. It's the best job on earth. Like, I'm seriously just the luckiest dude in America.
Wow. Talk about feeling blessed with your work. We were talking about that earlier.
Totally
before
full
in.
Circle. Yeah.
Yeah, because here's another. So, Chuck, I'm always talking about why I love FX out of all the networks, not just because you're here. I say it because I don't know another cable network that has such a diverse slate. You guys have everything. But the other reason I reference you is, you know, for myself, who's out there constantly pitching and trying to sell shows and things like that and dealing with all the Chucks of the world. What I always tell Maria use you now as the barometer of what a good executive is versus an executive that's not that good. Because when I talk to Chuck, Roxy, he's so excited about the shows he has going on, but then the new ones. And it's just, he turns into this little kid, and we have this, and we're doing that, and we're doing this. But Chuck, there's other executives. When you talk to them, it is not at all about that. It's about, you know what? We were profitable this quarter.
Yeah.
We're now making money. We let a lot of people go. We're making the tough decisions here.
We reached a different demo.
I'm like, oh my God, that's night and day compared to what I'm used to with you.
Well, look, you know, I mean, as COO, that's something that's really important to focus on, right? And ultimately, but I look at it from the standpoint that if our business is kicking ass and operating correctly, then all that great programming can be funded. And, you know, John Landgraf, Nick Rad, Eric Schreier, ultimately, you know, and by the way, Gina Balian and Nicole Clemens can then be funded to make exceptional programming. So, you know, ultimately, yeah, all that stuff's important. And I care desperately that we're profitable and we're making sense of business, but it's really so at the end of the day, we can make the best shows, you know, in America, at least I believe so.
Yeah,
and,
I mean, yeah, and well, again, the diversity of the slate, to me, it's like, to say what's the best, it's tough because it's always a subjective argument.
Yeah.
But I don't think it can be argued when we talk about the diversity, the fact you have Archer, cartoons. We've got Louis, you know, which is sitcom. But then we have
American Horror Story, The Americans, which, by the way, I think is the most underrated show.
How about
probably
this year?
Ever. I can't, like, get to the next week. I don't know what to do. Like, I am so obsessed with that show. I can't even tell you. And when I tell my friends about it, sometimes if I say it and they know it, they're like, that's my favorite show. And if they don't know it, I'm like, tonight, like, go home. Every single episode, call out of work because – that show is so underrated. But even It's Always Sunny, which is in like, oh, I don't know what, its 11th season or something. Mm-hmm. That show is better today than it was on its first day.
And think of the smaller shows like The League, which just finally went away, was amazing.
Absolutely.
Look, we work with some of the best creators. In fact, I'd say the best creators. Yep. Although, you know, to your point, best is a very weird and subjective word. And look, ultimately, I care about seeing a great television landscape with a lot of best. I don't particularly love the concept of a singular best.
Yeah.
My favorite award show of the year is the AFI Awards, because ultimately they name 10 amazing movies, 10 amazing television series, and they say this is the best of the year, and not one stands out, but a collective stands out. And ultimately, that speaks to Hollywood having a lot to offer, not just a singular show that stands apart from all others, but 10 shows that stand apart from all others, 10 movies that stand apart from all others. Right. And I love that.
Chuck, take us back. So you I know you went to BU, mm-hmm. and I want to know more about your journey, because we have so many, you know, people who at least tune into the show. They always want to know, like, how'd you get there? How'd you become a famous actor, famous host, whatever? How do you sell TV shows? But let's start with you. So what was your major?
My major was public relations, actually, at Boston University.
Huh.
But a massive, massive love of TV, total TV geek.
You mean you just watched a lot growing up, or?
Yeah. Yeah, everything. I just consumed everything, and I sat there and fascinated in front of the Boston TV stations as to, well, why is that show there, or why is that show there? And read TV Guide every week, back to back and front to front, and really, quite frankly, I chose PR as a major more to help me figure out the best pathway to communicating rather than really wanting to be in public relations. But I felt that that would help me with my writing skills. I felt it would help me with my speaking skills. And so that was my path. But ultimately, it was just another way to learn. I mean, ultimately, that's what college is you should be going to college not necessarily to learn how to do a job, because you're not going to learn that. You learn how to learn. You know, you learn how to read. You learn how to find information. You learn how to communicate better. It's
I love that.
That's
you
really
learn how
I
to
see.
Learn.
Yeah.
When did it shift to be television? When you moved out here? Or?
Well, that's what I wanted when I came out here. I mean, I had an internship in college. I actually worked for Columbia Pictures, and I was a college intern.
When you were in Boston?
In Boston, yeah. And this is 1983 to 1985.
Wow. Did the school set you up with that, or you just kind of went out?
It was an opportunity through the school. It was actually a kind of a crazy internship in that Coca-Cola owned Columbia Pictures at the time. And if you think about Coca-Cola all the way through its history, they are the master marketers of all time. They're the ones who really cracked the code on advertising, as we saw in the final scene of Mad Men. Right?
Yep.
There was no better marketer. And ultimately what Coca-Cola figured out was that movies were being consumed by college-age kids, people with expendable income, you know, people between 15 and 22. Not that college kids were 15, but, you know.
Yeah.
But it was right in the sweet spot of college. And they realized, you know, back in the day, if you think about the mid-80s or even prior to that, corporate sponsorship was not something you saw on college campuses. It was not something you saw anywhere. In fact, you know, they were stone walls that did not let you in. And so they figured out this idea that, and we were the first and last class to really do it. They figured out this idea that the way to crack the college campuses was to hire college kids as interns and have them work the college newspapers and college radio stations in an area. So I was hired for the whole Boston territory, which was awesome. And the first movie was The Big Chill. The last movie was St. Elmo's Fire. Ghostbusters was in there.
Interaction with the staff, actors?
Yeah, what would happen was when the publicists brought talent into Boston, it was my job to go and, you know, help, you know, to be whatever, the
liaison.
You know,
more
like the
guide,
intern who goes, gets a coffee or make sure that, you know, we ultimately get where we got to get to.
To make people comfortable and happy. Yeah.
And so I got to work with the main media at that time. But then also, you know, my job was also to put on screenings of their movies for every film they put out and throw, you know, basically give away 300 tickets to a bunch of college kids and invite them to an after party that I had to figure out how to throw. And
oh, my God.
It was the greatest college internship ever. And so when I left Boston University, when I graduated in 1985, it was either going to be film or television because I had this amazing passion for both. And I was fortunate enough to find a job in television, which was, you know, wherever I got the first job was where I was going to go.
Which, where was that?
I worked at Channel 5, local Channel 5, KTLA here.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know,
you applied all over the place, or that was just the first one you applied to, the first one you were accepted to?
I started to apply, but it was pretty early. I think I'd been here 30 days, and I drove out here and you know, really didn't know what I didn't know. I should have been completely frightened to move out here. That
pre-Facebook and pre, that's what I tell these guys.
God.
Before, like, you knew, you know, you probably knew nobody, right?
I was too dumb to know I shouldn't have done what I did. I had $500 to my name and a jalopy of a station wagon, and
Support from your parents, family, no help?
No, you know what? My parents, I don't think, really wanted to see me be out here. I think it was okay. You know, they supported me coming out here, but it wasn't like they said, here's a bunch of money.
They mentally supported
it. You know, I basically took the last paycheck I got out of Columbia Pictures doing that internship, and that's all I had to my name.
It was a paid internship.
It was a paid internship. Mm. I got $500 a semester.
Wow.
And so basically $1,000.
And so at KTLA, what are you doing there?
Man, I started at the bottom. You know, I worked in traffic. I worked as a log coordinator back in the day when, you know, there were not really computers and people used paper. And in essence, there was a whole book every day that gave the instructions of every ad that was going to be played and all that. And then I started to find out about this thing called research, and really because I'd hang out with all my friends, right? And all day long, everybody was convinced they knew what television was, what was the best show, and this is going to work, this creative idea is going to work, this creative idea is not going to work. And everybody at, you know, 21, 22 years old was, you know, full of their own bullshit, right? And am I allowed to say that?
Yes,
yeah,
of course.
You are.
Okay,
yep.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And so I got to the point where I was like, well, there's got to be a way to figure out what people really want and what people really don't want and how do shows get, you know, picked up and canceled and all that. And I found out that there was this thing called Nielsen, this company that, like, you know, surveyed audiences and in essence were the folks that helped determine whether shows got canceled, picked up, or whatever it was. And so KTLA had this research department. I was able to go to work there, you know, at the very bottom level. And I learned all about the metrics that are behind the economics of television.
Smart.
And because I didn't want to just be, you know, like another guy who thinks they know they're right, I really was intellectually curious to understand how the money was made and what made the decisions, how decisions were made, and then ultimately, hopefully, apply that later on in life to, you know, well, then, what's good TV shows? So as opposed to just pontificating about my own ideas, you know, have some kind of guidance and understanding intellectually.
Some science behind.
Some science behind television.
Wow. And so, which I just love,
right?
Because everyone else just thinks you're going to wing it. That they have this natural ability to say what's good and what isn't.
Look, I think there were 20 of us that came out from Boston around the same time that went to Boston University, and that's the way most of us were. We were all winging it. We all knew best. We all knew better. But that's what you are at 21 or 22 years old, right?
Yeah.
And you don't know what you don't know.
So how do you you graduate from, at some point you get out of the research thing, and when do you get into, say, more mainstream television?
Well, I actually did the research thing for 8 or 9 years.
Millennials, 8 or 9 years. Go ahead, because everyone here, it's 8 or 9 weeks, Chuck. So have to understand.
You know,
so, okay.
But 8 or 9 years, I did. I stayed at KTLA for 5 years, and then I went over to Columbia Pictures Television and worked in their research department. and worked with the, you know, the folks that were selling the content, selling the shows, selling to networks, both original content and back end content. So, you know, it was everything from syndicated talk shows like the Ricky Lake Show, which was around for a while back in the day, to back end content. I remember writing, the last thing I did at that job was writing the sales pitch for Seinfeld when it was sold into syndication. And so that was my days at Columbia Pictures. Wow.
When do we get into the creative? Like where?
Well, here was the beautiful thing. I was hired by the head of programming at KTLA, was hired to be the head of programming for a new startup network. This was in November of '93, called FX, that was going to be launched out of Fox. It was called FX because at the time the local Fox stations, basically would not allow them to create a cable network with the word Fox in it. So it's phonetic Fox, FX. Mm. Although I'm sure you could come up with other things too. Mm-hmm. And some
why
people
wouldn't
thought
they allow
it was,
that at the time?
You know, at the time that was their brand. That was what the stations, you know, so like KTTV and all the stations around the country that were Fox Network affiliates, they felt they owned the right to the name Fox, you know. And really that was the point of view until Fox Sports was launched. And then once some other brands were launched within and Fox Sports Nets, which were regional sports networks. And once that was kind of broken, the concept that the word Fox, which is a very strong, powerful brand name, could then be applied. But
a happy accident, because FX is far greater.
Yeah, but you know,
it
initially
gave your own identity and
initially there was confusion. You know, some people thought it was a site. You know, look, what's FX? Is that a sci-fi network? Is that a, you know, what is that? But you know, look, it's like anything. If you go through the litany of cable networks, you will find names. If you actually go into the history of the naming conventions of these channels, you realize that they were created to be something else. So, for example, do you know what ESPN is?
Mm-mm.
Okay. Do you know ESPN?
Well, I thought so, but I guess not.
Tell me what it was. Well, take a guess.
It's up there now.
Well, now
I can't
you put it
look.
On the screen,
yeah,
so we
I
can't
cheated.
Guess it, Jerry.
No, it's okay.
I was going to say sports programming, entertainment sports.
So it's original. Well, it is. So, but interestingly, it originally was the Eastern Sports Programming Network. So it really only programmed sports programming for the northeastern part of the country. And so it was out of Connecticut, as it is still.
Right.
And it was like Hartford Wheeler games and a lot of the colleges up there. So, you know, Harvard, Yale, you know, they featured the sports of the Northeast. So it was Eastern Sports Programming Network. Huh. And that was when it was a regional sports network, which is how it was launched. And then
I had no idea.
Eventually became a national sports network.
It's like getting a really bad tattoo and then just changing the meaning of it.
Yeah, so the E no longer stands for Eastern, right? Yeah.
Chuck, are you like me when you're watching on the weekends and what little time you have and you see 499 other channels? Are you not just spooked?
Nah.
Because I am. No?
Nah. Look, people want choice. I mean, forget about 499 other channels. How about the internet? Yeah. Every single URL is another network, in essence, right? Mm-hmm. Is another place to take someone's attention, and that's programming to somebody's needs in some way, somehow.
You just have to make amazing content, right? I mean,
so ultimately, you try to, you know, rather than trying to compete, there are certainly things that you want to pay attention to and compete with. You know, you're going to pay attention to, you know, don't run a male-driven show on Super Bowl Sunday. That's kind of a no-brainer, right? Mm-hmm. But ultimately, on any other day of the week, you've got to try to do your best as opposed to competing. Because if you do your best and you put your best foot forward and you put your best content on, ultimately you are competing. And my goal isn't to compete with them, but to have them compete with me. And so, you know, you try to do that through you know, just being thoughtful about what you're putting on and when you're putting it on, and what movies we put on, you know, what originals we put on. It doesn't mean that you don't pay attention to competitive environment. But, you know, look, during the fall, it's so hard because NFL is something that's just impossible to compete with, and it now owns four nights of the week, right? And yeah. It owns Thursdays, it owns Sundays, it owns Mondays, right? It owns, you know, basically college football.
Yeah.
You know, owns Saturdays. So you've got football. You got football in, you know, four very prominent places that are tough to take on.
Tough.
But you know, you do what you got to do.
So talking about, you know, we have a lot of writers who listen, and I guess I'd love to wrap my head around more of how the process. And I mean, I know for you, it's a lot of stuff is filtered to agents, right, that are sending you stuff.
Well, look, it's Nicole Clemens, although I'm not sure should I be like calling out.
You know, sure.
But look, she's our head of development, and
right.
And Nick Rad and Eric Schreier are heads of production and development, ultimately presidents of entertainment. It's bottom line is things aren't really going to find their way in the door unless they're coming from a reputable agency, because there's just too many crazy lawsuits out there. And
it's so sad, I know, yeah.
And quite frankly, it goes two ways. I mean, you know, you want to see things come through agents and through reputable places to ultimately protect the creators as much as to protect us, because you don't want to see them get ripped off. It's nobody wins when that stuff happens.
Do you still sit and hear a pitch? Will you still sit and hear a pitch, Chuck, or is that these other people do?
That's what other folks do.
But so how does something like, because people
know
this story.
I just figure out what to do with it, and you know where we can put it, and you know strategically how to best leverage it, and ultimately how to surround it with other content.
Okay.
People know about It's Always Sunny and how that happened, mm-hmm. and how that, so that didn't come through an agent. It wasn't pitched like that.
It was brought in through a big management company called Three Arts, and you know, they were represented. So they didn't just, you know, show up, knock on the door and say, hey. They were brought in the door by a very reputable person. But ultimately, we need to have some confidence in the folks who bring in product. So that, and by the way, if you're working with them in many other ways, that's part of what protects you. Because ultimately, there's too much to be lost if you get, you know, go down the rabbit hole of,
right.
of, you know, disrespecting the agencies or big management companies, and vice versa, because they have a lot of other talent that you want to work with. You don't want to be seen as a disreputable place. By the way, let's just go with what's common. Common courtesy and what's right. You know, you respect creators and you respect content. You know, you're not looking to do something disreputable. You want to have a very clean reputation as a company and as a network. And look, we pride ourselves on being very creator friendly.
Will you take no name creators though? So a lot of the, are there stories of no names that come through agencies or?
Because
I know you got the best of the best through the OJ case. Those are the best biopic writers in the business.
Yeah, but look, ultimately, yeah. Look, you can't survive into the future if you only look to the past for who you work with. You constantly need new, fresh voices. But those are typically vetted through the agencies, typically vetted through the management companies. And typically, you know, look, a lot of these folks are found at places, you know, at the festivals, at Sundances and all that. And so if they are, you know, if they've done a movie or small independent movie, whatever it is, typically the agents find them. They've got a really good nose for finding the best talent that is new and fresh at those festivals. So that's really the best place if you're creating content and you want to be discovered and find your way into the agency pathway, get yourself into a festival. And that's where small independent first timers are often discovered. And then once they're found and sort of vetted by the agencies, you know, the agents have a chance to talk to those creators, say, what are you interested in doing? You know, what platforms do you want to work in? Do you want to work in television, film? What's your, you know, documentaries? What's your love? What's your desire? What's your passion? And then typically that's where the agents and managers come in to help shape careers. And you know, when good ideas come in, that's when they get brought in.
You said festivals, but you also before mentioned URLs. What about YouTube videos? Do you feel
Look,
like that's
sometimes that's absolutely a place where folks have been found. And, you know, we've certainly seen talent come out of that world. You know, it's a little trickier out of that world, but it's not impossible. I mean, it's a great reel. I mean, look, when we were kids, Kev, we didn't have the ability to create a reel. We didn't have the technology to create a reel like that, and let alone be able to have it be seen by anybody in the world by putting it up on YouTube. So, yeah, I mean, it's absolutely a viable pathway to being discovered.
Different world.
Going back,
it is a different
bit.
World, dude. World. But that's okay, right?
Yeah, I love it. No, I mean,
hey,
I think
look
it's
again. You know, you gotta find fresh new voices, new takes on, you know, the human condition, and ultimately, the more ways you can give people a voice to show their voice and show the uniqueness of their voice, the better it is for those of us who love to watch stories be told, and I think that's really, you know, what it is, right? We want to understand ourselves better as humans. We tell me
you guys are hearing him say humans at least.
Humans.
I'm sorry. I always say humans, and we were just talking about that. It's the East Coast thing. Keep going.
You know
I'm
what?
Sorry.
I got so crapped on today at work about that.
I always do it. That made me so excited.
Literally, someone was like, you mean Y-O-U-M-A-N-S? And I'm like, yeah, okay, whatever.
I'm like, no, the human being.
Yeah,
don't
human
being. It was a Kirby Enthusiasm.
And the human condition.
He
right?
was like,
I'm
you.
So happy.
I'm such a Brockton boy. I'm
Hugh.
So sorry, right?
I'm so happy. I'm a Boston.
Wait, come on.
Larry David.
Wait,
did it on Curb. Remember, he said the guy's name was Hugh. And he was calling him you.
Oh,
you.
It's Hugh.
Yeah,
I loved that.
Come on, you're a Boston boy. Why can't you do it right?
I guess I don't know why. I mean, I do all. I still have my Boston accent, so I don't know why.
Maybe if you get drunk or angry, the humans will
human?
Come out.
Humans.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're talking about the human condition.
Yeah, we were.
The human condition.
Before we got
Sorry, okay. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Thanks, Gab. Thanks for siding with me there.
Yeah.
But look, that's what great stories are. And you know, for me, you hear the term quality television a lot, right? And ultimately, you know, if you try to ask people or nail them down, all right, what's that mean? And I think that quality television is something that reveals a truth about how we live and how we are as people. And it reveals an aspect of the human condition that probably felt very abstract. And it's that epiphany moment when you're watching something and you go, oh, that's what I was feeling. That's why I'm acting the way I am or feeling the way I am.
You agree we're in the golden age of television, would you say?
Look, you don't get to this golden age of television if you didn't have great television that preceded it. And so weirdly, I think every era probably was a golden age of television. I mean, how do you say that Norman Lear, you know, and all those great shows out of him wasn't a golden age of television? I think we always want to believe we're in the moment of the best and the greatest, but I think that there's been a continued
quality. But there was such
quality.
Crap, too, that I knew even as a kid was
hold
crap.
Hold on, and you're going to tell me there isn't still crap on the air today. There's a lot of crap
scripted
on the air.
Crap, it seems like scripted is far greater.
Really?
I think so. Okay, so you're very critical because,
I'm not going there. I'm not.
Yeah,
I'm
no,
not,
don't go there.
I'm not going to incriminate
myself. No, Rocks
myself,
will go there.
But,
no. What do we do without commercials? I mean, do you just, is it product placement?
Well, look,
what do you think? Is it going to be subscription? Where's this all going?
Look, commercials aren't going to go away. It's just going to be a different form of commercial, right? We're moving into a world of dynamic ad insertion and addressable advertising where we're going to have a pretty good idea of who you are. Not necessarily that your name's Kevin Undergaro.
But what I like.
But
right?
Yeah,
my interests, my hobbies.
We're gonna have a fairly good idea of what you like and when that type of person is watching. And so what you're going to be able to do is make advertising more effective. I mean, if you think about the advertising model of the history of television, you know, you're trying to find the right type of person watching a show. So if you're selling, you know, a $40,000 minivan, right, you're looking for a show with a high concentration of females, you know, around, let's call it 35 to 45, because that's who you're going to be, you know, people with
moms,
or even 30 to 45 people, mm-hmm, who are going to have kids that fit in minivans. And so you look for high concentration of that age group.
How do we stop them
women
from DVRing through them, though?
Well, we'll get there,
okay,
right? But ultimately, what, you know, and so you're going to have, when you buy into a show with that, you're going to have a lot of people who aren't the right customer for that. You're going to have a few people who are. But if you can just get to the few people who are, you might have people in that you know, car dealership over the weekend buying a minivan, that minivan that you advertise. In, you know, the future, you're going to know exactly who you're talking to. You're going to know you're talking to a 40-year-old woman that lives in a certain, you know, you might know their zip code or even their address. And so if you think about it, you know, if you just go to Zillow and type in an address, you know what somebody paid for a house. So you'll have a sense of their socioeconomic status. You'll know enough things about them that you can serve them an ad that's relevant. And instead of having to serve them 8 ads in a commercial break, it's going to be maybe one relevant ad. Maybe it's one relevant ad, a commercial break. Maybe it's just one relevant ad at the beginning of a show.
Before the stream, maybe.
Yeah, so, for example, Fox bought a company called Truex, and they specialize in something called engagement ads, where, in essence, at the beginning of the show, if you don't want to watch any other ads, you can choose the type of ad you want to watch. You engage with that ad for a minute.
You have to interact with it. I've been doing that,
yeah,
recently. So that's 30 seconds of interaction as,
yeah,
opposed to 2 minutes of watching.
But by the way, if you do that for 30 seconds to a minute, you've just done something great for the advertiser, because now there's an engagement with that advertiser. There's a memory that you actually looked at that advertiser's product.
Oh, I'm such a sucker for it. I love it.
And
I love these engagement
but
ads.
But by the way, and then you don't have to watch any more ads, or maybe you only have to do that 2 or 3 other times in the whole show. So instead of, you know, that thing where you're getting 40 minutes of content and 20 minutes of advertising, you now you can be in a world where shows are just like, you know, when we were kids, and they're 55 minutes of content in an hour and 5 minutes of advertising and promo.
And you just got to get the apple juice to the baby.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's...
No,
it's,
I've been loving
so
that.
So the technology...
There's
hope.
So, Doctor,
the technology,
there is hope.
Oh, my God, dude, there's such great hope. And by the way, the value of that ad, where an advertiser... Look, ultimately, what an advertiser pays in the traditional model of today and the past is, you know, they're also paying less because they understand that they're going to get a bunch of people that aren't relevant to them. So they pay what they pay because they're getting some relevant people and some irrelevant people. In the future, they're going to be getting to the relevant people, the people they want to get to. And so that ad's going to be worth many, many, many times of multiple of what an ad is worth today, because they're not going to be getting the waste. You know, they'll be getting to the person they want through engagement or through targeting. And so there's tremendous hope for our industry in the future. And by the way, won't that just make a better viewing experience? So I think that, look, if you look at the Hulu model, which I think is fascinating, you know, Hulu was getting a tremendous amount of complaints about commercials. And, you know, people didn't want commercials. But, you know, what it really was, it's not the whole populace of Hulu subscribers that were complaining about commercials. It's a small percentage, but that small percentage can be very loud.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're in 12 million homes, roughly. So if 1% of 12 million complains, that's a tremendous amount of complaints. What's that, 120,000? Mm-hmm. If you saw 120,000 complaints, tweets, you'd be like, oh, my God, but it's 1%. If I told you 1% of the people were unhappy with what you're doing, right, you'd go, okay,
well, 99% are happy with
that. 99% are happy. That's breakage. That's, you know, what happens in any business. And you can't please all the people all the time. But if you saw 120,000 complaints, you go, oh, my God, this is crazy, right? So they offered, for more money, a commercial-free option. And then they also continued to offer, at the lower price, a commercialized option. The people who wanted to pay less money accepted that they'd get a few commercials. It wasn't an overwhelming amount, but they accepted they'd get a few commercials. And the people who really didn't want to see ads were willing to pay a higher price. And so there are going to be a lot of economic pathways to figuring out how we offer content in the future. And that's,
and you really have to be the best. I mean, you have to, like, so FX puts out such a portfolio that you're going to be willing to spend the money if you're a consumer.
You have to have great shows, but you also have to have a great viewing experience. And so that's the model of the future. So what's the play out we're hearing?
This is, I'll let you listen for a second. Roxy, do you like Hulu? Do you listen to it? Do you watch anything
on
Hulu?
Yeah, I have Hulu. I have Netflix.
But Hulu original programming?
No, I don't watch a lot
of
their original programming.
I'm curious about Hulu original.
But a lot of people do. A lot of my friends do.
They like
the original? Yeah. I think I'll get more into it. Kev, I did see...
Why are we listening to Van Morrison?
Attaboy, you got it. Good man. You're the first one to guess.
It closes out
when he was with them. Good, Chuck. You're amazing.
Yeah.
All right, so Chuck is like... is a huge rock and roll fan. He goes to every Springsteen. I know you and Marie have been going back.
You a big Springsteen fan?
Huge.
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 Huge. Huge.
Last show I ever went to with my mom, Springsteen.
Oh.
She followed Springsteen. She went to like 58 shows of his from all around.
I'm in a sick amount that I won't admit to.
Oh, yeah.
Chuck had me on the floor of one of them, which was amazing.
Oh my God.
It's a religious experience.
He's the best.
The one is like over and over in my head. Keep going. Sorry.
The name of the song. What is the name of the song?
It's all over now.
Baby Blue.
Baby Blue. Yeah. So you knew the song was written by Dylan. I like his version better.
Yeah.
I like them's version better. Chuck, I know you do a lot of work with autism, so maybe a shout out to the charity of your choice.
Yeah, Autism Speaks, which is a phenomenal, phenomenal charity.
Maria doing another show? When are we doing? Are you going to do that again?
I'd love that, man.
The one we did last time?
I'd love to have you and Maria back.
When is it, though?
You know, we've got something coming up on the 21st of May at the Pantages.
Oh,
if you like Neil Young.
Yeah, a little bit. My favorite was the last one. I knew you wouldn't tell this story, but I have to tell it. At the last one, all these people gave their donations, and Charlie Sheen, God love him, he hands Chuck, I think, a check for how much. It was like $100,000. And when Maria talked to him about it, he goes, you know, fuck all these other celebrities and their goddamn $5,000, $10,000 fucking checks when they have more money than fucking God. He's like, bullshit. You give a fuck. This is the fucking check you give. Gotta love Chuck Sheen. That was awesome.
That dude has a big heart.
He really has a big heart. Big heart. Anyway.
It's like he's a misunderstood soul from that standpoint.
Yeah,
you know?
Good man, though.
All the tabloid shit gets in the way.
We've always had good experiences with him.
There's a good-hearted man there.
Yeah. We like him a lot. We changed the expression tiger's blood to dragon's blood.
We have dragon's blood.
A little Game of Thrones thing?
Yeah, kind of. A little bit.
A little bit. Okay. It's Autism Speaks. Chuck Saffler, thank you so much, Chuck, for coming in and educating us. I feel so much better now. I might be able to keep this house.
Dude, there's a really bright future for television ahead.
He's been down about it.
A sustained golden age. And by the way, those millennials that you're down on, don't be down on them, because I think that there's a lot of pathways to keep them in the house. I think one of the things that's really critical for the future is understanding that, you know, look, by the way, when we were kids, when we were in our 20s, we were nomadic in a lot of ways.
Right.
I mean, think about it. You were moving all over the place.
Sure.
I know your background. You were way all over the place.
Yep.
And, you know, planting your roots and...
We're going on loop.
I love that.
We're letting you talk.
But there was, we were all over the place. We weren't really settled down. And by the way, we only had so much money, and who wanted to carry a TV around? these kids, they have iPads, they have computers, they have ways to watch TV, and there are going to be
They're great consumers, but they don't pay, Chuck.
Look,
they don't know how to pay.
Here's
but
the thing. It's not that they don't pay. It's that they're not going to pay the $200 that, you know, they don't, that basically I can go out and, you know, meet a girl or a boy on the weekend at a club or at a bar, or I can spend all my money on TV, and that model doesn't work, and the cable operators understand that, and the programmers understand that, and that's why you have things like the announcement that Hulu made the other day that they're going to offer a collection of channels at a lower price, and that's why PlayStation View was created and the Sling product.
We just need people like you to figure it out, Chuck. We need smart people to figure it out, because you bumped me out again.
But there's going to be going to be lower cost packages that these millennials can buy that they can take, whether they're, you know, watching TV
okay,
or
Roxy,
on the
but
train.
But we'll be honest, Roxy, will they even give a dollar? I mean, they don't like this, Chuck. They think everything is theirs.
I think they'll give, not you, Roxy, but
because you have dragon's blood. The rest of the millennials. Tell us, your friends, would they put up the money?
Have faith in people's honesty. Have faith in that people are willing to pay for things until they get frustrated to the point where they can't.
Okay, Jared at 32 in the booth. Go ahead, Jared. Go ahead.
No.
Be honest. Come on.
The whole system needs revamped right now.
That's
and for
what I'm
sports
saying.
Fans, don't even get me started, because there's not even an avenue for anything.
Yeah, that's true.
Look, there is. I'm telling you that there's a pathway, and it's going to be a reasonable pathway. And you watch. There's going to be pricing that makes sense. For the regular
Chuck,
dude or woman that loves TV. Mom.
Listen, we have to say goodbye at some point, but. Well, I think more TV news comes in. We're going to have Chuck come in and explain this stuff to us.
You got to.
As time goes on. Chuck, thank you so much
for
coming in. We'll see
you
again.
Thanks, Roxy and Kevin.
Yes. And Thursday.
And humans.
All the rest of the humans will be back Thursday night, where we will, of course, be drinking, because it's Thursday night.
Yeah, we have fun on Thursdays. Because Friday's for the men.
Hang on, you guys, till then.
Much better I'm here tonight, then.
Yeah, you're here for the right. You're here
much
for
better
the,
for
the
my
professional
reputation.
Night. Exactly. Yeah. You don't want to be at Thursday show. Things go bad. Things go bad, but in a good way. You guys, at the Tomorrow Show, hit us up, thetomorrowshow.com. I am your captain, Ed Undergaro, and you guys, again, we'll see you Thursday. Thank you so much. Make it a better tomorrow.
Thanks for tuning in to The Tomorrow Show with Kevin Undergaro. For guest bookings, questions, or comments, you can email us at info@thetomorrowshow.com. Be sure to follow us on social media and tell a friend about the show. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, your voice of tomorrow, wishing you a better one.